Welcome to Agile Clips, where we break down Agile into manageable pieces. In this episode, we discuss Agile in the real world, where theory meets practice. Hi, Santosh.
Scott, how are you?
Very good, thanks. And you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's been a while that we haven't had a chance to record our podcast. I think that ChatGPT gave us some few ideas. I think we just took off from there for a while.
We chatted with it and not with each other.
That's true. Well, you know, it actually talked some interesting things in my mind, in the sense, how do you talk to a young agilist, and you know, that one who has actually just read the book and reading it back to you, that kind of an experience.
Blew my mind was the fact that when asked about confronting a difficult CEO, its 10th point, I think, recommendation was make sure you look after yourself as well.
Yeah,
that was incredible.
that was and you know, it starts at a different mindset, in the sense, depending upon who you are talking to or what's your intent out of it, it did change its answers. And it also said, oh, there are more things, would you like to hear that? Which was, I thought, that is pretty interesting, that they're actually
definitely
so that there is some depth to it, for sure, whether we intended to go in that direction. But what started in my mind was that the answers that were coming back were lot more bookish than the real world.
Right.
And when you start looking at, and that's, I think that's what we are dealing with day in and day out. When we talk to our teams, our, coaches, they have been through the training. They have been through multiple trainings of the same thing. Well, how to write a story, how to write a feature, how to write this, that, you know, all those things. And when they are actually faced with the real world problem, they really struggle. And I think that's where the missing or the gaps are. Like, well, I would like to, you know, at least let's talk about that, in the sense, what are those kinds of things that we are seeing? And where the coaches can make a really good difference. And one of the things that that's my thought.
I think we face this all the time, and we see coaches who are very theoretical themselves and seems like they're not living in the real world and dealing with the practical problems that people have. So yeah, I think that's a great topic.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I kept on going back to, in the sense that the part of this, you know, when we were at the IC Agile, 1 week, that intense course that we had, one of the things that they were constantly saying is meet them where they are. And it's that kept on resonating constantly in my mind. It's like, how do you meet them where they are? And it's, I think once we as a coaches or even just agilists start talking to the teams and or your, the team members, understanding where the difficulty is, where the gaps are, or where the rubber is meeting the road, where where is the resistance coming from? Because what I'm finding is that the team becomes like a magic wand. They said, you know your agile thing. And the managers, their managers or the management team is like, do your agile thing and deliver what I'm asking. And that's kind of they're like, oh yeah, we were supposed to do this. What does that mean to me? What does that mean to my daily problem? And I think that's one thing that I really started appreciating, is to asking them those questions as to what's stopping you from applying these agile principles. And I think that's it's very easy to say, this is the agile manifesto, use this. Really?
Yeah, this totally reminds me of good marketing. And what I mean by that is, bad marketing is where you have a product, you have a set of features, and you just sell the features. Maybe you don't even sell the benefits, but regardless, you're going from that direction rather than really understanding the needs of the customer. And then the marketing, and indeed development of the product should address the actual needs of the users, not because it came from your company.
It was funny you should say that, because I was having this one session a few years back. They said, we need to get this done because we have identified 20 pain points. And the business folks had said, these are 20 pain points and we have a solution. Here is how we should get it done. And they asked Agile teams, why don't you take this and run with it and get it done for us? I'm like, oh, wow, this is really interesting that you are actually telling them how and you hired these people to do this.
To use their brains.
Yeah, exactly. So I started the other way. I asked them, okay, you had this 20 pain points. If let's go one by one. And if this gets addressed, what is the benefit you will get? You know, what happened was when they started listing the benefit, there were only 4 benefits that came out of those 20 pain points. And I said, oh, so this is quote unquote why you want to address these, is it? So if these 4 are addressed, you'll be happy.
Minimum viable product.
There you go. So actually, that's what came down to. And then the team said, oh, is that the 4? We know how to get this done. So all this effort that these guys had done to go through how, you know, what data structure has to be there, what this one, I'm like, time out. These guys are pro at it. Why are you doing that for them? And literally those 4 things got done in a month and a half. And they're like, they were thinking, oh, this is going to take at least, you know, 3 quarters minimum, 8 to 9 months. So what it shows basically is once you deal with, that's where I started thinking, you know, that's where the business agility will really start making the difference. If you tell the teams why and what, and now, not how, you will be surprised how better results will start coming back.
In fact, carry on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, just today, I was telling my colleagues, since we're looking at making some process improvements and we're redefining what needs to go into a PRD, which I know PRDs are not always in favor in the Agile community, but we have them, or we're introducing them, I should say. But I was telling people today, focus on the desired business outcome in the PRD, not the details of every feature. So let the teams figure out the features, give them the flexibility so that they can be agile, but be very clear about what the expected outcome is. Totally. And that way, they can be innovative and bring a lot to the party.
Another thing that I asked them to do was, out of those 4, from when we deciphered that into, it was like, these are the 4 things we need. I said, which one you want to finish first? So, you know, everything is important. Well, I said, if everything is important, that means nothing is, because they will give you the easiest thing that they can do. And you just said everything is important, so it is important. And you go, I'm like, which one would you like to finish first? And then the wheel started turning. It's like, I said, well, I'll give you different ways of doing it. Use weighted shortage job first is one of the things, or do a bubble sort. Well, say, put those. And they're like, we never had done this before. Like, yeah. So, and that's what led to a lot of things saying, so we don't have to spell everything out here, right? I'm like, just give them a feedback whether this is working or not. Is this what you were really meant by? So that's what I'm talking about the real world. When you say, you know, how do you really have that conversation versus contract? Those are the conversation. Ask them to deliver something quick and then say, you're going in the right direction. I didn't mean by that, or we didn't mean by that, but that's the conversation. And they were like, we didn't realize that. I'm like, now you know. But it started the whole, the side effect was they actually started talking to each other, and they created, these guys are not that bad that I initially thought. They seem to be a good humans here. Like, ta-da!
Well, this is exactly to your point, that you can read the Scrum Guide, you can read about prioritized backlogs, but how you actually achieve it is a whole different story, and what works in one environment might not work in another one.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where those conversations really makes a difference. Let's try these things out if it is complicated. You're doing it for the first time. Wouldn't you like to try this out first? And they were like, but we are not set up that way. I'm like, I understand. If you are not, let's set it up that way. What did we take to get this? Oh, we need to talk to these people. Okay, what will it take for us to get these people? And then all of a sudden the dialogue started, you know, differently, because now the management started, oh, is that what you're asking me to influence? Yeah. I said, ta-da! Instead of telling them what to do daily, help them to get these things. And I never use the word servant leader. I'm like, because that's a, because now even the Scrum Guide has taken that out. So I said, you know, tell them what you want and then remove everything that is stopping them from getting done. So use your influence, your position to get that, you know, facilitate that. And they're like, oh, that is a lot more easier. I said, yeah, these guys are, you don't need a babysitter. Once they have the thing moving forward, they will get it done. And it's, I think it's that instantiation of that each, example. That really changes the outlook for them. The only thing that happens there is the conventional way of leadership, the, you know, control and those things. They feel that I'm supposed to give up my control. I'm like, I don't think you were hired to control the people. It was, you were hired to do the strategy and, you know, getting to the higher goals. Isn't that a better deal than doing this mundane stuff? And they're like, maybe let's give it a try.
I think really it's not a surprise, but a lot of the complexity really comes in when you have multiple teams,
true,
right? All the coordination between the teams and how the work gets split up and being able to rely on every team and to you know, deliver on what they said they would do in a sprint, and all that coordination becomes so critical. And that's, I think, another area where the leadership can provide guidance and help with orchestrating everything.
Truly, truly. I mean, they can influence a lot of this, the cross-organizational dependence, because they have the purview of whom to go to and whom to, you know, which levers to pull. The teams doesn't. Teams, they're like, and one of the things I always give them an example is like, if the environment is down by a day, out of this 2 weeks sprint, you just lost 10%.
Right.
Of your capacity. So when you're saying we have a commitment to agility, this is that 10% commitment every day to make sure that none of those 10% gets wasted. They're like, oh, I didn't look at it that. I'm like, yeah, those things get, you know, rolled up, and then you will see a snowball effect into that. So it's a aha moment for them. Okay, these guys are smart guys. You know, they know how to get. Instead of controlling the wrong things, control the ones that will make a difference.
Absolutely. And it also just, you know, in general, we've been talking about how teams can struggle and so on. But I've also seen coaches, I hate to say it, but there are some coaches who just try and enforce the rules, so to speak, regarding what the behavior should be, rather than being very pragmatic about what's needed by the organization. I don't think it's a common problem, but I have seen it in some cases.
No, it's a universal problem because it is true. You know, sometimes I mean it. We just get a tunnel vision saying that this is agility. You are not being agile. Well, there is a reason why, you know, they don't want to. There may be either there is a misconception about that, or there is the constraint that is driving. So, you know, if you start asking those, that's why I liked about those powerful questions. You know, it really changes your outlook towards that, saying,
right,
ask them to answer the question. As to if they say, oh, this is not working, I'm like, okay, so how should it really work? What is stopping it from working? It's like, instead of, oh, have you tried this, and other? No. Now,
that's true, you know, coaching.
A couple of times they came back and said, oh, nobody has asked us that question before. And I said, well, isn't that what you really want to address that? And so it was interesting. One of the things that we looked at, you know, oh, nobody shows up for the retrospective. I'm like, ask them what they were looking for in a retrospective. And what did you do wrong? Is everyone is trying to point that out. I said, okay, then what should that look like? And they said, well, if it was wrong, how somebody who is pointing that out is going to help? So, you know, one of the teams we did, or a couple of teams in our we did, was I said, if you are going to say that we should do this this way better next time, or after that, write down and I will do this to make it better. So it's not just you give advice to somebody else, do this. No, if you are part of the team, what will you do to improve that? And, you know, it was interesting how people started changing their even what to point out. Because if they did not have answer, what they will do, they're like, I better shut up. If I can't make a difference, then who am I trying to tell somebody else to do that? And it changed the whole team dynamic, because now they were committing, saying that, oh, I will do this. So people said, okay, come on, let's do it. Then you just said you were going to do that, and let's work on it. So go ahead.
Yeah, recently I was working with a team that is just awesome. I mean, they don't necessarily always finish what they say they're going to finish in a sprint, but that's because they're just overcommitting. I mean, they, for whatever
more
reason,
more optimistic in the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. But the amount of high quality work they deliver is unbelievable. Just one of the best teams I've ever worked with. So we always kept doing retrospectives, and they were very productive at the beginning, and then they sort of got into a routine. So I like to change it up every retrospective, do it in a different way.
Cool.
So one that I did was, let's all agree on a movie, like the Star Wars movie, and then tell me which character you are and why you're that character and what you felt about what happened during the sprint. And it was so fun. Like, people were felt like they were just taking orders from somebody, or they felt like they had a superpower because they achieved something. But it was just surprising, A, how fun it was, and B, what the ideas that came out of it.
That's cool.
So there's so many ways of running a retrospective, and
absolutely,
and also different ways of making it very actionable instead of just like a complaining session.
Correct.
Which is, you know, along the lines of what you just said. But I was also thinking about something you mentioned earlier, which is these coaches who like to follow the rules and do it the way it's supposed to be done. It's ironic because Scrum was intentionally designed to be a very light framework that gives a lot of opportunity to tune it and improve it. So it works in an organization, and yet some people are very loath to do that, to actually use the retrospective to figure out how can we work better together.
Yeah, it's like a regimenting free flow. It's like, come on.
Right.
But it is so true that those, instead of using the guardrails, that becomes almost like a prison cell. You cannot go out here. This is what this is. It's like, no, you have to be able to have an open sky on one end, but just don't go onto the cliff. This way.
So the other funny thing is, I was listening to a podcast recently, and the person being interviewed was one of the co-authors of the last revision of the Scrum Guide. So it has two names on it, but it's actually reviewed and edited by a lot of people. And so this guy was one of them. And so they were asking him about some of the terminology. And he said, like, people put so much emphasis, like it's a Bible and every word is correct and was argued for ages. And this is the way it's supposed to be. And I don't remember the exact examples, but there were some words that we couldn't think, oh, the backlog, we couldn't think of a better word, so we just said backlog. So even the basic things like that, there were just, in some cases, the words were just the one thing they thought of. In other cases, there were long arguments, and so they made changes. I can't think of the specific examples, but anyway, after a lot of debate, things were kept very general and so on. So, yes, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of thought that went into it. But when you look at the details, hanging everything on a certain word or specific thing that's said is incorrect. They're just trying to convey a spirit.
Well, I mean, that was not the intent behind that word. You know, the Agile Manifesto principles. The intent was simplifying things and keeping things in a more fluid manner, so that we can adapt things to a better way of looking at it. And I know one of the things that when I was talking to Jeff Sutherland, he basically said the whole idea behind this was how people work and interact together. That was the concept behind Agile. It had nothing to do with these principles. You have to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That was not how people interact
right.
and respond.
Exactly.
That's the agility. Now, you can put all these, you know, different things around it, but are you still working together or not? And are you delivering things? Who are you doing it for? So it was pretty, as you said, that thing was not meant to be like a, you shall do this, like a Ten Commandments kind of thing. It had no intention of that.
And then on top of that, there's all the layers that people have added, like user stories and story points and all of those things that are not really technically part of Scrum. They're just techniques that people have found to be very effective, and it's great that we use them. But so often people forget what the actual Scrum definition is versus all these other things.
Yeah, I think the most favorite thing is that velocity. That has been used as a biggest weapon against all these things, and people are like, ah, I need to measure the velocity. It's like, really? How many points velocity do you need? We can always inflate the story points, and the voila, you will get the velocity that you are looking for. goes out the door has nothing to do with that velocity number.
Exactly.
Anyway.
I was once in a company, and there was a big debate going on regarding what do you do with a story that's half done at the end of the sprint. Do you carry, do you not carry it over? Do you repoint it and just decide what's left? And that's the story in the new sprint, so you can calculate the right velocity and all of that. And this argument was going on for so long. And one day I thought, I'm just going to Google it and see. And then I came across this long public thread, and the people in that thread were the people in my company who were discussing it among with many others also. And it was just going on and on without any resolution.
It almost becomes a religious discussion. This is what my principles are. And so then everyone. So at the end, I always ask the question, is that what does your customer think of? Do they care whether you did it in 2 stories or 5 stories or no stories? And how many points did it come out? They don't care. Right? Like, show me the money. Give me the functionality.
Right.
Where did it go? And how did it get there? Talk about that, whether you did it in 2 sprints or 3 sprints or 1 sprint or no sprint. Does that matter to your end user and customer?
I really like the flow metrics as I'm not going to say an alternative, but just understanding how long it takes to process things. And you can't always use that to predict the future, but that's the thing that's really interesting, and more than the sprints, in my opinion. See stories that have taken 6 sprints because they were blocked. Why were they blocked? And you can get a lot of information out of those metrics.
Totally, totally. And I think from in the customer point of view or the consumer point of view, they requested something, and when it showed up on their screen or wherever it's endpoint, that's what they care about, that the whole lead time and all those. So look at it from that angle. How long is it taking for you to get it delivered to whoever is asking for that? That's drives NPS, that drives customer satisfaction. All those things get delivered, driven by that. So why don't we focus on that as to what are the constraints that is taking 12 weeks, 18 weeks or 3 weeks, or whatever that is. That's where the in that manner to serve, minimize the waste.
Yeah, I remember in one of our earliest episodes, maybe even the first one, we talked about that there's always so much pressure on the developers, the engineers, to produce something, and it may have taken 3 times as long to get from the salesperson through the product team to decide this is a priority, and then actually releasing the product with all the marketing and everything that goes with it. And yet the pressure always seems to be in the middle on the poor engineers who are being rushed to deliver quickly. But as you say, from a customer perspective, it still took all that long period of time.
Correct. I mean, that it was interesting. You know, one of my friends in India, he bought a new car, and now they have this interface that I said, where is the car? He said, no, it is in the shop. I said, well, what happened? Oh, there was some defect, this and another. But you know what? They are sending me a daily where, like, oh, the part has started from Germany. Now it is in, Mumbai. It's coming to this one. I'm like, dude, this is great. But you are still taking Uber to get anywhere, right? So who cares whether they did it with, you know, with the left hand or right hand or whatever. With, you know, standing on one leg, you finish that. Who cares? You still are inconvenienced and your brand new car is sitting in the shop there. So is that a good quality or what is your experience? I said, yeah, you know, previously I used to go directly to the mechanic and say, I need this car tomorrow, and he would give it to me.
At the same time, it's an information radiator, right? So it's better to get some updates rather than being totally in the dark and wondering what's going on. But you're right, of course, it's still inconvenience at the end of the day.
And yeah, you know, I might be happy about this one time that, oh yeah, look, this I'm doing that. But if it doesn't get delivered, then why the heck did I pay so much money? And you know, so the next time I said, well, will you buy the same car again? I said, no way. This thing is in more time spent in shop than at my place. So there is that NPS.
It's funny you should mention that example because it ties into the definition of ready.
There you go.
So I had a problem with my car. Somebody hit my car. So the bumper had to be replaced. And it was absolutely drivable. Mm-hmm. But the shop took it in. They said, okay, we'll have the part on Monday, bring the car on Friday or something like that. So I took the car in, and then they kept it for weeks because they were waiting for the part.
Part, yeah.
And I had a car, a rental car, and the insurance only paid for 4 weeks, so it ended up costing me a decent amount of money to keep that car, extra time. And I told them afterwards, you should have not taken my car if you were not ready. So they didn't meet the definition of ready. By having all the constraints
and
removed.
And I know that thing just was sitting in their parking lot.
Exactly.
For waiting for this. So it's like, you know, what's the point here?
But
So it's, I mean, that if you consider the same thing in our, you know, software development, we are waiting for this to be so then why are we taking this on? Let the, you know, don't stop the progress. Keep the things flowing.
And definition of ready.
Right. I mean, that's the real world agility.
Yeah, because so I don't think it's mentioned in any Scrum guide or anywhere like that, but these are the things you have to look after.
Exactly. And the thing is, finally, look at it from the customer's point of view. What is their experience in this? So maybe they just want a small thing to run. No, in your case, you would have said, just remove that damn bumper, but let me at least take the car. You know, it's okay. It's still drivable. It's okay. And when the bumper is there, I'll bring it the night before. You put it there, and 2 days later, I'll have the car.
Exactly.
So I think that's the crux of it. And it's the same thing for features or products. Where is it? What is the crux that is making the change? And can we make it in the smaller increment point? That's the real world issue. And then
definitely,
it'll be sitting in our backlog. Sure. But that's why I like those aging reports. Really, the aging reports are pretty cool.
Yes, so, definitely. And in some tools, you can have the ticket change color the older it is, so
totally.
It really stands out.
Yeah, because then you put some guideline around that, you know, these are the SLAs, and it's not meeting, then the color gets red and throbbing red, and, you know, alarm bells go off, basically.
Definitely.
I have to get some attention. But yeah, those are the real world, I guess, agility point of view. And, you know, people used to do that even in waterfall days, but they were not classified in that sense. And I think that's the mindset change, that how can I keep on returning back the value or the, you know, somebody told me today, it was really, really interesting. You know, you can build a product and you can say, yeah, this is all done. You know, definition of done is met. But the value gets delivered when the end user uses. Till then, there is no value. It sits
absolutely
on the shelf.
Yep.
It's like a shrink-wrapped software. It sits there. Unless the end user starts using, there is no value.
That's correct.
So let's start looking at that. You know, how much is your end user using? I think one of the sessions I had in last conference, they gave some really interesting, you know, statistics. They said, you know, most of the software or the products that get launched, 85% of them never get used. Only 15% of the real products get used by the intended user. So 85% money is thrown out the window just because somebody thought that was something cool that we should do.
So you mean 50? Only 15% of the features of the product are used.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Which I think is the statistic that always used to go around with Microsoft Excel, that only 15% of its features were commonly used.
True. True.
Yep.
That's because I know how much Excel I use. And all the other stuff is just, I'm like, I don't want to use that. But yeah, you're right. You're right. Exactly. So where is it that you really use that? And it makes a difference. You can shove the things into it just because you think it's cool.
And then it's, of course, it's a huge cost, because it's not only the cost of developing those 85%, but then you have to maintain them and you have to retest them.
Truly.
When you do
yeah.
regression testing, it's a huge cost.
Yeah. And yeah, the whole product becomes just, you know, top heavy kind of thing.
Yes, right.
These other things get loaded and nobody's ever actually using it. So that's one of the things that they were, I mean, the whole session was about the telemetry data.
Mm-hmm.
They were saying, right, why telemetry data matter is that they showed this whole, and it's not just one industry, industry-wide, that there was this 15% bullseye. That was the only thing that was being used, truly used, and then everything else was just the fluff, because, you know, it's everyone's interpretation, and it's that, and they just keep on loading more things onto it. Even if you look at your own car, you use maybe the 15% of the main function. The rest of the other stuff that is floating around in this infotainment, this and that, the other, I don't think you even use it as much as they were intended to.
So I mean, I have about, in my car, there are 10 different versions of the clock that you can display.
Right.
And I've, other than playing with it the first day I got the car, I've never changed it again.
Yeah, and does it, so I mean, those are the things. It's really that telemetry, I mean, that was the eye-opening thing about why telemetry data. And I think that may be something that's the most useful measure. You know, when you put it in production, run the telemetry data around that and see really how many people are really using what, and maybe make those 15% functions better instead of, you know, having those pet rocks in those features.
Correct. There's a whole thing about the idea of overcoming friction. So for products to be adopted, there's usually some friction, and there's a tendency for people to just want to pile on more power, more to push the rocket, so to speak, and which would be adding more features. But in fact, if you want it to take off, the best thing you can do is make it more aerodynamic. You'll get a much better bang for your investment that way. So sort of ties into even with products like this, to focus on how can you make it easier for people to adopt it rather than trying to give them more features that won't necessarily help.
Funny you should mention this, because there was one session, they said, what is the business leader's function in this agility? And one line just stuck in my mind was that they are the ones who can remove the things away from those features that still get the things to the customer. So instead of piling on some of the things, they should be the ones saying that, oh, that's okay. We don't need that right now. We don't need that right now. Just give me this. minimizing what is really the crux of it. And if the business leads start pulling those things into that because they understand the customer, then real needs will start showing. And you have tools to look at. So I thought, you know, that's brilliant.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Cool. I think we've gone in all kinds of directions, but all related to how do you make agile work in the real world. So
real world.
It was a good conversation.
Yes, as always.
So I think we should wrap up at this point.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners for supporting the podcast and listening and subscribing.
Yeah, and we are looking forward to hearing back from them.
All right. So take care, Santosh, and
okay,
the best to all our listeners.